Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
This is Jim Petzer, your host on The Raw Deal. What do we have? The 15th day of January, 2024, Martin Luther King Day. Let me say a few words about Martin. His death, like those of JFK and RFK, and even like 9/11, was not at all the way it's been presented to the American people. In the case of RFK, he was shot by a sniper in the bushes whose name was not James Earl Ray, who was the patsy, just as Sirhan was a patsy for RFK, and Lee Harvey Oswald was a patsy for JFK, and 19 Islamic terrorists and Osama bin Laden were the patsies for 9/11. Because he was firing from the bushes, they would chop down all the bushes immediately thereafter, even though they were crucial to the crime scene for a forensic examination, just as after 9/11, they hauled off the debris from the World Trade Center, lest it be subject to a forensic inspection. And, what can I say? These things are absolutely 100% routine. There's a standard operating procedure for these kinds of assassinations. What William Pepper discovered, and most of you would have no idea, is that Martin actually survived the shooting on the balcony of the Rain Motel in Memphis and was then transported deliberately to a hospital more distant than necessary, while a racist physician who was in charge of the ER chased everyone else out and then smothered him with a pillow. I'm telling you, this stuff is absolutely stunning, and it's just one more indication of how far removed from reality are the stories were given by the mainstream media. Now, this is a matter to which I shall return by and by. Meanwhile, I'm going to focus today primarily with my special guest when she joins me, Layla Paul, who was a reporter. She's a Christian Palestinian woman. She was wildly popular in her day and who has become one of the, in my opinion, leading experts on the situation we're dealing with in Israel today. But I want to begin with an interview with George Galloway of an ambassador, a British ambassador, about the situation. This is as good an overview of the big picture as we are likely to ever have. Check this out.
Please welcome the Honorable Craig Murray. Craig, thanks for joining us. I hope your bones have thawed. I'm past the age now where I can safely sleep on a sidewalk, on a pavement, in a sleeping bag in The Hague in January, but you did it. So before you get into the nitty-gritty of the case itself, kindly paint for us a picture of what the whole scene was like, of what the whole experience was like in The Hague.
Well, it was extremely difficult to get in. I mean, the public gallery admits 14 people for a case of world importance. 14 people were allowed in. On the first day, there were eventually perhaps 400 people in the queue for those 14 places. I had to get there literally at 2 o'clock in the morning and start queuing up. And that day, that first day, I didn't have a sleeping bag, and it was -5. It was very cold. And I stood there till 6:30 in the morning when they finally gave out the passes for people to be admitted. But it was a good atmosphere. All 400 people who were trying to get in, every single one of them was a fervent supporter of the Palestinians, I think I would say. There was an excitement about it. People believed this was a chance for justice, a chance to actually do something, and a chance to hold the perpetrators of genocide to account. It's also worth saying that Jeremy Corbyn and Jean-Luc Mélenchon both turned up to be in the public gallery. Both of them slightly cheated in that they had somebody stand in for them for a while, but they both still nonetheless turned up themselves at 5:30 in the morning and stood for 2 hours in sub-zero temperatures, queuing to get in. And of course, once the event started, there were many thousands of people gathered outside to support. People had come from all over Europe. People had come from I met people who'd come from Australia. I met people who'd come from Pakistan. I met people who'd come from Peru and people who'd come from West Indies. It really was quite a gathering of like-minded people. And there was a definite feeling that this was a major turning point in history. Now, either international human rights law and the idea of international courts and international justice was going to prevail, or we're going to see that all that is a thing of the past, but essentially the United States and the United Kingdom and their allies have destroyed the idea of international law, and that the only law is force and the ability to kill your opponents. And that was the real feeling of the event, I think. This is an absolute turning point in history where the international community and international humanitarian organizations actually stand up to the United States, or they are effectively finished.
It was a red letter day inside, wasn't it? I have seldom seen, witnessed, an unrelenting, brilliant, unanswerable case pressed for hours by such talented counsel as I saw on Thursday in the South African case. Did it feel that way to you?
It did. It was electric at times inside the room. And I thought what was particularly brilliant was that the South African team took a definite decision not to rely on emotion and theater. You know, they could have produced literally thousands of photos of dead children, you know, of maimed children, of mutilated children. They could have appealed to the emotions in a very direct way because of the appalling things that are being done to the people of Gaza. But they deliberately did not do that. They didn't show one single atrocity photo. What they did was very calmly and rationally set out the absolute horror of what is happening in words. And the words piled up one after another, but there was no theatrical or emotional delivery. It was reason, pure, hard reason, setting out the arguments, setting out the facts. And the facts were so horrible in themselves, you didn't need anymore. And certainly in the South African delegation, which I could see below me, and in the public gallery, there were tears in people's eyes. The problem is, of course, the judges. And the judges just did not look comfortable. But to my mind, they looked like they did not want to be there. You know, they'd been put in an invidious position where an unanswerable case, really, has been set out against Israel, which means against the United States and the United Kingdom as well, because they are obviously implicated in providing the weapons and support and intelligence and surveillance and everything else. And, you know, what are the judges to do? They look like they would love to find any way of getting out of this because, you know, they are establishment people, of course. They face the difficulties that come into your life if you stand up against the United States and Israel. And they very much look like they would love to find a way out of it. The only times they really got animated is where procedural questions were being discussed, where questions of jurisdiction were being discussed, and the question of whether or not there was possibly an argument that South Africa didn't have standing to bring the case or the court didn't have jurisdiction. Those kind of things were the only things that really made them animated. And it was fairly obvious, you know, if they could find a way to duck this, then they would.
Craig, I talked to another British ambassador, retired British ambassador, yesterday in London, who incidentally recalled the days when he used to read your dispatches from Uzbekistan and opined that these were dazzling, brilliant dispatches, although, as he said, focused on human rights, which, of course, is what got you sacked. You were over-focused on human rights, according to the Labour Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, at the time. But as a man so long in love with the idea of international law, of human rights, and so on. And I confess, I never really was. I always felt it was lipstick on a pig. I always felt there was no such thing as international law. Where do you stand now, as much a dedicated defender of the international legal structures and systems and so on? Or do you feel, especially if this case goes the wrong way, that it's over, that all that stuff was for the birds?
Well, you're right in that my entire working life and career, both when I was in the Foreign Office and outside, has been dedicated really to trying to make the rule of law, the rule of international law stick and international humanitarian law stick. The greatest blow was dealt, of course, over the war in Iraq, where the UK and US invaded Iraq with their allies, not only without having Security Council agreements, but in the direct knowledge that the Security Council disagreed. You know, after months and months of trying to get Security Council agreement, they could not get. And you know, I said at the time that what we are doing to the United Nations is what Hitler did to the League of Nations, or Mussolini did to the League of Nations when he invaded Abyssinia, for example. So I think that was a huge blow. Whether the structure of international humanitarian law could ever recover was an open question. There was another huge blow when the International Criminal Court decided that it could not prosecute Bush or Blair over the Iraq war, and then decided it could not prosecute British soldiers over offences committed in the Iraq war, even ones which had been committed after the Statute of Rome came into effect, because their excuse about Bush and Blair was that their actions were before the Statute of Rome came into effect. So that was another blow. And I think it's difficult. It's difficult to hang on to belief in the system. There have been many ICJ judgments over the years which have been respected, and it does look, for example, as though eventually Britain is moving towards respecting the ICJ on handing over control of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, for example. So, you know, there are occasional beams of hope. But no, I mean, in this case, the case for genocide is so overwhelming, so unanswerable in logic, that, and this is such a major thing. You know, this is a genocide being carried out before the eyes of the whole world in an age where, despite the killing of journalists, everybody's been able to see it. And no, I shall give up. I mean, if this court ruling goes the wrong way, I will have to decide that the only hope for oppressed people is in armed resistance. And there is no effective chance ever of remedy through the international system. And I should be very, very sad to reach that conclusion. But I do think that is where this is potentially leading.
Now, the right to protect that bogus substitute for international law, the United Nations and the rest, devised by the aforementioned Tony Blair and Bill Clinton in the Chicago Doctrine, turns out to exist for shipping containers too. We have the right to protect shipping containers on Israeli vessels or on other vessels going to or from Israel in the Red Sea. We have the right to make war on a sovereign country, Yemen. And now we've had 3 days of relentless bombardment, almost 100 targets across the country. And today, a port, yesterday, the airport, the Sana'a International Airport yesterday. We're now at war with Yemen. I say we, effectively, I mean the US and the UK again. Because although there are one or two satraps acting as Batman for the occasion, the killing is being done by UK and US troops, yes, entirely without legal justification, yeah, on an international level, and even the rubber stamp of a parliamentary vote. We've been killing Yemenis all my life, Craig, and all of your life.
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely illegal in international law. Plainly, there's no justification for it. The Yemenis block shipping lanes to try to stop the killing in Gaza. And we respond to that by killing Yemenis, as opposed to by stopping the killing in Gaza, which would be the more logical way to reopen the shipping lanes. And as you quite rightly say, this has a long, long history. Yemen was conquered by the British during the first Afghan war, in fact, back in the 1840s. And has a long and noble history of resistance. Of course, in the latest phase, for the last decade, we've been killing Yemenis too, really using the proxies, the Saudis as proxies, but armed with British, largely aircraft and weapons and bombs, and supported by British special forces and with maintenance of all those weapon systems by British personnel based in Saudi Arabia. This is just, if you like, the latest and most blatant phase. It's very horrible. I want to just move on, though, to day two of the ICJ hearing, which was just astonishing. I've only just published, literally in the last hour, published my account of day two. Partly because it was so difficult to write, because the things the Israelis were saying, you couldn't believe they were saying them. You just could not believe this actually was seriously being said in a court of law. They said, for example, that the reason there were so many damaged civilian buildings and infrastructure and houses in Gaza was that they'd all been damaged by Hamas booby traps and the misfire of 2,000 Hamas rockets, and it hadn't been Israelis who had damaged the infrastructure at all. They said that there are now 50% more food trucks entering Hamas every day than were entering before October the 7th. They said they had found incontrovertible evidence that every single hospital in Gaza was used by Hamas as a military base. And that's just some of the stuff they were saying. And it was quite incredible. You know, it's as though they sat down and thought, well, how do we tackle this? And then they said, well, let's just respond with totally outrageous and unbelievable lies to everything and thus make a mockery of the entire proceeding. It felt sickening. I felt dirty after sitting through 3 hours of this. It really was astonishing to be there and hear such guff, which they knew was rubbish. I mean, they don't believe it. And they knew the judges don't believe it. The purpose of it was, of course, international propaganda. Because the court's not actually going to accept any of those things as fact. Their total lack of respect, if you like, their arrogance, their sense of impunity, that they can just tell any kind of outrageous lie they want.
Let me just say, I think that's about as good as it gets in terms of a global overview of the situation. Yeah. We, of course, have the U.S. and the U.K., as reported, striking sites in Yemen. This is absolutely outrageous. Biden, U.S. president, said American and British forces with support from Australia, Bahrain, Canada, and the Netherlands were involved in the attack. The initial at least 60 targets at 16 locations that are in direct response, he claimed, to unprecedented Houthi attacks against international maritime vessels in the Red Sea, including the use of anti-ship ballistic missiles for the first time in history. He's not observing that Yemen has declared war on Israel, and the ships are interdicting are bringing supplies to Israel, and only the ships bringing supplies to Israel. So this is a completely dishonest, hypocritical, mendacious statement by the United States. The military, U.S., said the Houthis had launched 27 attacks when the rebel group fired a cruise missile into shipping lanes in the Gulf of Aden on Thursday, according to U.S. Central Command. Meanwhile, the Yemen government has replied, all U.S. and U.K. interests in the region are legitimate targets now. The Yemeni Supreme Political Council issued a statement on the joint U.S.-U.K. overnight aggression against Yemen, warning of imminent retaliation. Here's what they said. What the country has been subjected to is an unjustified and illegitimate American-British aggression, which violates all international laws. They are 100% correct. All American and British interests have become legitimate targets for the Yemeni armed forces in response to their direct and announced aggression against the Yemeni Republic. The aggression is an extension of the treacherous American targeting of the Yemeni naval forces and American-British Zionist aggression on the people of Gaza. The American-British aggression is a real threat to international peace and security, putting the region at grave stake. The presence of American and British forces and those allied to them under false pretext in the Red Sea and the Bab al-Mandeb Strait is rejected and violates all laws. This presence is a threat to international navigation and is the duty of the Yemeni Republic to deal with it the way it sees fit. We affirm the commitment of the Yemeni Republic to what was declared at the beginning of its naval operation to end the blockade, stop the aggression, end the genocidal war on Gaza, and allow the entry of food, medicine, fuel, and all means of life. Hal Turner, who made his report, offers the following observations about the Houthis for the benefit of Americans who may not understand what's going on here at all. They don't follow your movies and TV shows. They're not bothered by your media or social media. Psychological warfare is utterly useless against them. They are natural-born fighters, really, no kidding. Their life goal since childhood has been to fight America. The last will and testament passed down from their ancestors is to liberate Palestine at the very least. They have 4 to 5 wars of military experience in various terrains. They've all written and recorded their life wills in audio and video formats. The martyrdom of any of them is a tremendous source of pride for their children, family, village, province, and country. Their poets passionately glorify war more than any love flirtation or romance poetry. They all obey their leader, the great Abdul Malik Badr al-Din al-Houthi, with absolute obedience. Their only fear is the punishment and wrath of God if they fail to support the people of Palestine and backtrack on their support. They love death as much as you love life, if not more. So it has been the question here. Has Biden violated the Constitution by bombing Yemen? I have no doubt. Here's section, third clause of section 10 of Article 1. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships at war in times of peace, enter into any agreement or combat with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. This is just outrageous what's going on here. From L.J. Powell, who of course part of the SWAT, this is an unacceptable violation of Constitution. Article 1 requires military action be authorized by Congress. Here's Cori Bush. POTUS can't launch airstrikes in Yemen without congressional approval. This is illegal and violates Article 1 of the Constitution. The people do not want more of our taxpayer dollars going to endless wars and the killing of civilians. Stop the bombing and do better by the U.S. And what has been the response? The White House has conducted additional strikes in Yemen. They reported Saturday's strike targeted a radar facility missed during Thursday night's initial attack. The strike was conducted by the USS Kearney using Tomahawk missiles and was a follow-on action to a specific military target associated with strike taken on January 12. The initial attack was conducted jointly by the U.S. and the U.K. Yemen issued a defiant response. We'll be right back with my special guest, Layla Paul.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
While I await Layla joining me, I shall continue to report. The Biden admin claimed the strikes were needed to restore freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. The Houthis, who control North Yemen and most of the country's population, have hijacked one ship, attacked about two dozen others. They're targeting Israeli-linked ships because Tel Aviv is conducting a genocide in Gaza. They've even declared they're going to cease once the genocide ends and they allow food and water, fuel and electricity to enter Gaza. The White House assertion that strikes are justified to ensure international trade is questionable. For most of the past 9 years, Washington and Riyadh have maintained a blockade of Yemen, leading to an humanitarian crisis in the Middle East poorest country. U.S. has also attempted to substantially restrict trade with North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela, Russia, China, Syria, Afghanistan, and Iran. So who the hell are we to tell the Houthis they can't interdict for such a noble and appropriate cause? Biden's authority to order the strikes in a country against which Congress has not authorized war is in question. The president needs to come to Congress before launching a strike against the Houthis in Yemen and involving us in another Middle East conflict. That is Article 1 of the Constitution, Representative Lo Kahana posted on Twitter. Democrat lawmakers Pranjal Jaipal, Val Hoyle, Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, Mark Pocan, Barbara Lynn, Sarah Jacobs have all publicly attacked Biden over the strikes in Yemen. Mark Pocan, by the way, is mine own representative, and in this instance, I support 100%. The president was also attacked by conservative Republicans. Thomas Massie, for example, said Congress needs to address presidential war powers. He posted, the U.S. had been involved in hostilities in Yemen in one form or another for over 5 years now. The sad reality is Congress frequently refuses to assert its authority. Biden claims he has the authority to order the strikes as a defensive action. However, the Houthis have never attacked the United States. The Houthis are enemies of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, a terrorist group that's attacked America before Saudi Arabia launched a war against the Houthis in 2015, which Barack Obama elected to support. U.S. Central Command, then led by Lloyd Austin, backed the Houthis against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula at the time. Austin, in my opinion, the now late Secretary of Defense, was enraged by the decision. According to a senior officer who told the Quincy Institute, Mark Berry, Lloyd was enraged by Saudi intervention because we were quietly supporting the Houthis fighting against Al-Qaeda at the time. Meanwhile, here's Colonel McGregor with his thoughts about what's going on.
Well, actually, I do read. I'm not able to get through all of the books all of the time, but I have so much good material to draw on that, yes, I read, you know, General MacArthur, who is one of my idols, if you will.
The American Caesar, as a famous book is called.
And he and I are also related, you know, so his ancestors and mine come from the same area in Scotland. And he made it a point always to spend 2 hours a day, even throughout World War II, to read. He would have books available. He had a huge library that he'd inherited from his father, but he always took 2 hours a day to read. And he read history. He read cultural matters, philosophy, law, in order to stay mentally agile. And I think that's what you have to do. If you don't read, you sort of, you're living on old intellectual capital, and eventually that wastes away. So yes, I do try to do the same thing. Some days are better than others, obviously, but no matter what, I try to read.
And at the moment, what is for you personally the most interesting book or the most interesting reader who appeals to you the most?
Well, actually, I just received a copy of a book by a German author, a very notable historian. I don't have the book in front of me. If you'd told me ahead of time you're going to ask me these questions, I would have placed it here. It's going on in their own countries, because we know large numbers of West Europeans do not like the fact that they have admitted millions and millions of people from North Africa and the Middle East. Well, of course not. We are allowing millions to flood into our country. It's only a matter of time until that explodes here. But the bottom line is that's separate and distinct from what's happening in Israel, because the Israelis are, in effect, conducting a campaign of mass expulsion and destruction against that population. So all of these contradictions work together to isolate us. And right now, the United States is perhaps more isolated than it has ever been in its history, which is kind of entertaining if you stop and think about it, because people like me that have always opposed these overseas interventions are called isolationists. But we were never interested in isolating the country. We wanted to do business with everyone. Our position was, why are we interfering in the internal affairs of others? But now we really are isolated, and it's only going to get worse from here.
The dark absurdity of unintended consequences. So fascinating what you are laying out here. Public enemy number one of this ruling class in the United States is the former president, Donald Trump. It's amazing. I mean, I would have never thought that he had a realistic chance to come back to the presidency. I talked to some people over the Christmas days, among them, I don't want to quote them, but some people, you know, from the you could say international establishment, you know, these people at these conferences, and they are not totally friends of Donald Trump, but they are saying they think it's quite realistic that he could return to power. How do you see that? And would this ruling class, this powerful establishment in the United States, would they ever let it happen that Donald Trump could ever return to power? Or do we have to face a scenario that Tucker Carlson once explained when he said, well, if they don't can bring him into jail, they will probably try to shoot him. I think that wasn't a joke. I mean, he thought it was seriously. Can Trump return to power?
I think it's a real possibility. Anyone who excludes it is foolish. But let's be frank about something. Donald Trump, RFK Jr., and anybody who is on the left that stands up and eventually becomes a candidate, what do they all have in common? They have all, unfortunately, unconditionally supported Israel. And even Trump has said that if he were president in the future, things such as those things that happened in Ukraine would not happen because he would bully the Russians into submission. In other words, I'm strong, I'm tough, and I can force these people to do what we want, which, of course, is entirely stupid. Now, to RFK Jr.'s credit, he has not said that. He actually takes the same position that I have over many, many years, that our relations with the Russians should be good. There's no reason why they should not be good. We do not have any vital strategic interests that collide to the point where we should be at war with each other. But having said all of that, there are too many globalists in the camps of all of these candidates. So in that sense, I think the population, the broader electorate, still remains isolated from the candidates. There is no one standing up and saying, wait a minute, we live in a world today where our problems as great powers, France, Germany, the United States, take your pick, wherever you want to go, Great Britain. Our problems are internal. They're not external. There are no existential military threats to the United States. Russia threatens us only because we have threatened them. And if we stopped, it would stop. China? Good Lord, anybody who knows anything about Chinese history knows that they're not going to attack anybody. They've got the same problem they've had for centuries. Too many Chinese. They've got to manage it. You know, that's every morning Xi wakes up and he's not worried about us. He's worried about what he needs to do to hold China together. And right now, between the banking system, terrible mistakes in the central planning system, economically, financially, China's in a lot of trouble. No one ever brings it up. You know, somebody pointed out the other day that Xi had executed the top leadership of the Chinese Navy, or excuse me, rocket forces. Mm-hmm. Well, that's nothing new. I mean, corruption is endemic in that country. It's everywhere. And we shouldn't be surprised by that. But people are looking at you. Gosh, I didn't know that.
Let me just say, well, I generally think Colonel McGregor is a source and fountain of wisdom. I would disagree with him regarding Trump. Remember, he came into office saying he wanted to have good relations with Russia. I do not believe his attitude has changed. And look, if he were really on the Zionist bandwagon, why not go with Trump? Everyone wants to support him. Just put him in president. He'll do what you want him to do. They're acting precisely the opposite. They're going all out to stop Trump. And mark my words, these are the Zionists. These are the military-industrial complex. This is the deep state. Trump threatens them, have no doubt about it. In my opinion, the most powerful evidence we have that Trump is a good guy are his enemies, well illustrated by the fabricated legal cases brought against him that have no foundation in fact or law. Regrettably, Layla is not contacting me. I suspect she may have been sabotaged. I shall persevere. Here's Wayne Root offering the following observation, and this is a very smart guy. Ever wonder what it would look like if the U.S. were at war with the Houthis and Iran and China and Russia and North Korea by implication at the same time? While military admits there are no recruits and we sent all our weapons to Ukraine, get ready. Get ready for the most interesting year in American history. I'm delighted that Layla has now joined me. Layla, we've been reviewing the attack on the Houthis in Yemen. I'd welcome your comments about it. Layla. Layla, I thought I had brought you in, girl. Try again, try again, try again. Wow. Some days. Meanwhile, we have lots of reports about Israelis genocidal. Here we go. Let me try again. Layla, are you there? There are genocidal statements at the International Court of Justice. The evidence of genocidal intent is now a challenge. It's also overwhelming and incontrovertible. Get this. South Africa attorney Thembeka Nugatabala Thursday. I'm trying to admit you, and I don't know why. Try again. I don't get it. I'm seeing you show up, and I'm trying to bring you in. Try again. Try. I'm trying to. Layla, I'm trying to pick it up, okay? That same one I gave you before. 466. No, I'm here and I'm trying to pick it up. So thank you. Using the words of PM Benjamin Netanyahu and other high-ranking officials to make the case to the International Court of Justice and to the world that Israel's military is acting with clear genocidal intent. She should have joined. Let me see. I'm trying to bring her in, and for whatever reason, it isn't happening. Very disturbing. Let the prime minister's words speak for themselves. Point out that Netanyahu's November remarks urging Israelis to remember what Amalek has done to you. I'm hoping now we have everyone together. Layla, can you hear me? Layla. Okay, I'm going back now to the...
Let's turn now to one of the most controversial live political questions in the world today, Israel's assault on Gaza and whether it is legal under international law. South Africa is taking Israel to the International Court of Justice, accusing it of violating the Genocide Convention by the way that it's acting, that it intends to destroy the Palestinians throughout Gaza. Israel, of course, has rejected the claim and application, saying that South Africa is in effect calling for the destruction of the State of Israel. I'm joined now by Professor Francis Boyle, human rights professor and a lawyer who was the first to win a genocide case at the International Court of Justice. It's very good to see you there, Professor. From what you've seen of the South African case, what is likely to happen, do you think? Do you think Israel is going to be accused or found guilty of genocide?
Well, thank you very much for having me on. My best to all my friends in Britain. To clarify, I won the first order of provisional measures of protection ever issued by the World Court on the basis of the Genocide Convention. That was for the Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina against Yugoslavia. It was massive, overwhelming. And then I won a second order to the same effect.
I remember the cases well, sir. I remember them well. So what do you make of this case?
Right. Well, I have read all the legal pleadings, and I stayed up all night to watch the hearings. South Africa has presented a solid case, I would say an airtight case.
I'm giving you a different...
And based on everything I've seen, my knowledge, judgment, and experience, I believe the South Africa will win an order of provisional measures of protection against Israel to cease and desist from committing acts of genocide against the Palestinians.
Well,
that would be an enormously significant moment. But, of course, Israel has a long history of, brushing off criticism and critiques from the United Nations and the international community. What would happen as a result of this if it did lose the case that would cause real problems for Israel?
Yeah, see if that'll work.
Yes, South Africa can then take the... order to the Security Council for enforcement. Right now, it looks like the Americans would definitely veto any enforcement. I regret to say it appears the UK government would also do the same. That would not be the end of the matter. It can then go to the United Nations General Assembly for enforcement under the terms of the Uniting for Peace resolution. And the consequences for Israel could be quite severe.
And presumably, whatever the Israeli government thinks or does, many, many Israeli citizens would be intensely embarrassed and angered by this. And it may well, of course, change the political atmosphere inside Israel.
You're correct, because the origins of the Genocide Convention came out of the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews. And that is why it says in Article 1 to prevent genocide. Namely, the convention is there to make sure you don't have a another Nazi Holocaust against the Jews, but that the international community acts in cases of developing genocide. Yes, and that might be a blow over there in Israel, sure.
And to look at the other side of the argument, the Israeli government is arguing, in effect, that if it doesn't do what it's doing in Gaza, then Hamas will revive and the State of Israel will eventually be eradicated and destroyed. And that, therefore, it's a question of one side obliterating the other or the other way around.
Well, that's correct. Your Oxford professor, Lowe, had anticipated the Israeli defenses, and I think he did an excellent job of presenting them this morning. In my cases, I demanded a right of rebuttal against Yugoslavia, which I got. So I had separate rebuttals there. For some reason, South Africa did not request rebuttals. It's not obligated. It's discretionary. But Professor, I think, did an excellent job.
Stand by. We'll be right back with our ongoing effort to cover the genocide trial against Israel brought against...
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Layla and I continue our frustrating efforts to get connected. Genocide expert discount Israeli legal arguments. Indeed, while the court hearing was underway, Al Jazeera was reporting 9 Palestinians, including children and at least 1 infant, had been killed in another Israeli strike on a residence in Rafah. Faced with detailed documentation of statements made by top-level Israeli officials about their intent to destroy Gaza residents and flatten the enclave, legal experts observed that attorneys representing Israel on Friday appeared to simply ignore the mounting evidence that the government is committing genocide. Thomas McManus, a state crime lecturer at Queen Mary University of London, said the ICJ, which has held 2 hearings this week regarding South Africa's complaint, likely noticed a massive disconnect between Israel's claim that it's trying to protect civilian lives and the reality on the ground. The hearing on Friday was underway as Al Jazeera reported 9 Palestinians, including children and at least 1 infant, had been killed in another Israeli strike on a home in Rafah. Just a few of the 23,708 who have been confirmed dead. Meanwhile, a defiant Netanyahu says no one can halt Israel's war to crush Hamas, including a world court. Rafah, Gaza Strip. Israel will pursue its war against Hamas until victory and will not be stopped by anyone, including the world court. PM Benjamin Netanyahu said in a defiant speech Saturday, his fighting approached the 100-day mark. Netanyahu spoke after the International Court of Justice at The Hague held 2 days of hearings on South Africa's allegations that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians, a charge Israel has rejected as libelous and hypocritical. South Africa asked the court to order Israel to halt its blistering air and ground offensive as an interim step. No one will stop us, not The Hague, not the axis of evil, and not anyone else, Netanyahu has said in televised remarks Saturday evening, referring to Iran and its allied militias. Here we have part of the presentation in the court that has been so impressive.
Of jurisprudence at the University of Sussex. Prior to joining prescribed by the statute, please be seated. I take note of the solemn declarations
and its
of oral
and distinguished members of the court. It is an honor for me to stand here in front of you on behalf of the Republic of South Africa on this exceptional case. In extending our hands across the miles to the people of Palestine, we do so in full knowledge that we are part of a humanity that is at one. These were the words of our founding president, Nelson Mandela. This is the spirit in which South Africa acceded to the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Crime of genocide in 1998. This is the spirit in which we approach this court as a contracting party to the convention. This is a commitment we owe to the people of Palestine and Israelis alike. As previously mentioned, the violence and the destruction in Palestine and Israel did not begin on the 7th of October 2023. The Palestinians have experienced systematic oppression and violence for the last 76 years. On 6 October 2023 and every day since October the 7th, 2023. In the Gaza Strip, at least since 2004, Israel continues to exercise control over the airspace, territorial waters, land crossing, water, electricity, and civilian infrastructure, as well as over key government functions. Entry and exit by air and sea to Gaza is strictly prohibited, with Israel operating the only two crossing points. Given that continuing effective control by Israel and over the territory of Gaza, Israel is still considered by international community to be under belligerent occupation by Israel. South Africa unequivocally condemned the targeting of civilians by Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups and the taking of hostages on the 7th of October 2023, and has again expressly recorded this condemnation, mostly recently in its note verbal to Israel on the 21st of December 2023.
Churches, and as they try to find food and water for their families, they have been killed if they failed to evacuate. In the places to which they have fled, and even while they attempted to flee along Israeli declared safe routes. The level of killing is so extensive that those whose bodies are found are buried in mass graves, often unidentified. In the first 3 weeks alone, following 7 October, Israel deployed 6,000 bombs per week, at least 200 times it has deployed 2,000-pound bombs in southern areas of Palestine designated as safe. These bombs have also decimated the north, including refugee camps. 2,000-pound bombs are some of the biggest and most destructive bombs available. They are dropped by lethal fighter jets that are used to strike targets on the ground by one of the world's most resourced armies. Israel has killed an unparalleled and unprecedented number of civilians, with the full knowledge of how many civilian lives each bomb will take. More than 1,800 families, Palestinian families in Gaza, have lost multiple family members, and hundreds of multi-generational families have been wiped out, with no remaining survivors, mothers, fathers, children, siblings, grandparents, aunts, cousins, often all killed together. This killing is nothing short of destruction of Palestinian life. It is inflicted deliberately. No one is spared, not even newborn babies. The scale of Palestinian child killings in Gaza is such that UN chiefs have described it as a graveyard for children. The devastation, we submit, is intended to and has laid waste to Gaza beyond any acceptable legal, let alone humane, justification.
And return to what it was before. We will eliminate everything. We will reach all places. Eliminate everything, reach all places without any restraints. The theme of destruction of human animals was reiterated by an Israeli army coordinator of government activities in the territories on 9 October 2023, who, in an address to Hamas and the residents of Gaza, stated that Hamas has become ISIS and that the citizens of Gaza are celebrating instead of being horrified. He concluded that human animals are dealt with accordingly. Israel has imposed a total blockade on Gaza. No electricity, no water, just damage. You wanted hell, you will get hell. The language of systematic dehumanization is evident here. Human animals. Both Hamas and civilians are condemned. Within the Israeli cabinet, this is also a widely held view. The Minister of Energy and Infrastructure, Israel Katz, called for the denial of water and fuel, as this is what will happen to a people of children killers and slaughterers. This admits of no ambiguity. It means to create conditions of death of the Palestinian people in Gaza. To die a slow death because of starvation and dehydration, or to die quickly because of a bomb attack or snipers, but to die nevertheless. In fact, Heritage Minister Amichai Eliyahu said that Israel must find ways for Gazans that are more painful than death. It is no answer to say that neither are in command of the army. They are ministers in the Israeli government. They vote in the Knesset and are in a position to shape state policy. The intent to destroy Gaza has been nurtured at the highest levels of state, as President Isaac Herzog has joined the ranks of those signing bombs destined for Gaza. Having previously noted that the entire population in Gaza is responsible and that this rhetoric about civilians not aware, not involved, is absolutely not true, we will fight until we break their backbone. Later attempts by the president and others to neutralize this speech have not altered the sting of his words, which was to tar all Palestinians as responsible for the actions of Hamas. Nor, as I will show below, has it affected how state policy is understood within government. The Minister of National Security repeated the president's statements that Hamas and civilians are responsible in equal measure. On 10 November 2023, in a televised interview, he stated that when we say that Hamas should be destroyed, it also means those who celebrate, those who support, and those who hand out candy. They are all terrorists, and they should also be destroyed. These are orders to destroy and to maim what cannot be destroyed. These statements are not open to neutral interpretations or after-the-fact rationalizations and reinterpretations by Israel. The statements were made by persons in command of the state. They communicated state policy. It is simple. If the statements were not intended, they would not have been made. The genocidal intent behind these statements is not ambiguous to the Israeli soldiers on the ground. Indeed, it is directing their actions and objectives. On 7 December 2023, Israeli soldiers proved that they understood the Prime Minister's message to remember what the Amalek has done to you as genocidal. They were recorded by journalists dancing and singing. We know our motto, they are no uninvolved, that they obey one commandment to wipe off the seed of Amalek. The Prime Minister's invocation of Amalek is being used by soldiers to justify the killing of civilians, including...
Let me say that, South Africa has been doing a superb job of all of this. I have Layla on the phone. Layla, you are giving us a rundown of why you think there's going to be a mixed result coming from the court. Could you go back over, because those were such important points you were making.
Yes, I think the problem could be the permanent members of the Security Council. We have the U.S., which we know is going to vote against South Africa. We have the U.K., Britain, which we know is going to vote against South Africa. We also have Russia, which is already under indictment with an arrest warrant issued for Vladimir Putin. And so they're likely going to vote against it because they don't want to open the door to genocide accountability of any accusations. Then we have China, who also has charges but, of genocide against them regarding the Rohingya.
But,
and France is unknown. Recently, Macron has been saying more generous things, more realistic things about what's happening on the ground, honestly, and that's the fact that everything is beyond sanity. So he's a question mark. France is uncertain.
But Leila, am I misunderstanding you? They're not judges on the International Court of Justice, are they? You're talking about what action might be taken by the Security Council, and Francis Boyle was addressing that yes, if they make an unfavorable ruling to Israel, that the Security Council might veto taking any action, but then go to the General Assembly. So are you mixing apple and oranges? I mean, you're right about the membership of the Security Council, but so far as I know, wrong about the composition of the court.
Well, let us assume that it is a judge from each of the countries has been appointed. The only thing we're going to get now is an interim measure, and that interim measure is going to come anywhere from now until the next 3 weeks, even that time is uncertain. So let's say that we get a favorable decision. It then takes about 3 years before they actually make a final decision or judgment. But between now and then, even in the interim period, it may come before the Security Council before they actually deliberate in order to come up with a stronger conclusion. Now, theoretically, the judge's decision, and again, you're right, it is the judges that are appointed by each country. The judges are going to change within now and the next 3 years when the, or however many years it takes for them to make a final judgment, and the countries that appoint judges are going to change. But no matter what they decide, it still has to be approved by the Security Council. So it's almost irrelevant. First of all, Israel is going to ignore the ruling. Just like Vladimir Putin ignored the ruling of the ICC, not the ICJ. I believe it is in the ICC because it was against him personally, whereas the ICJ only deals with a complaint by a nation between nations. So the ICC's ruling was negative for Putin, and it issued an arrest warrant, and all he did was ignore it and avoid countries that were members of the ICC and could have arrested him. So it's meaningless. Now, Israel has never obeyed any law. It is unlikely now, since they are God or Satan and above the common law of mere mortals, they're not going to obey any law unless this particular panel of judges believes that what is happening is so injurious to all of humanity, and they decide to send out a military to actually take action, which is highly unlikely, because the only ones who are engaging in military action right now is what they're calling the Houthis in our part of the world. In the Arab part of the world, they call it Ansar Allah, means the servants or the protectors of God. They're very, very strong. They've always been very efficient warriors. They have survived almost 9 years of an assault by Saudi Arabia, who now has made peace with the Houthis, and the Saudi Arabia wants to come back into the GCC, which is the seven countries that belong to the Arab Gulf countries. So now Saudi Arabia realizes that it cannot trust Israel. If Saudi Arabia does not have the strength to defeat the Houthis after 9 years and causing thousands of children to die from cholera while Saudi Arabia was attacking them, and the Houthis still won, granted they had Iran blocking and the equipment, but it was the Houthi warriors who did the fighting. So Saudi Arabia now is back in the fold of the Arabs because it wants safety, because it knows Israel will slaughter them next. If they can't beat the Houthis, they're not going to beat the Israelis. So meanwhile, Hamas is not, it's impossible to defeat Hamas. It's impossible to defeat Hezbollah simply because you cannot kill people who do not, who believe that dying is winning, as long as they die in the name of justice and in the name of the God that they value and are devoted to. Iran is not involved. Iran wants peace. It wants to stabilize its circumstances. Anyone who thinks that Iran is actually going to initiate or publicly become involved in this war is delusional or very ill-informed. Iran is going to sit back and deal with its own internal problems, which include a social division as well as a weak economy and other crises. But Iran has enough money that it can, and enough military acumen that it can advise Hezbollah, the Houthis, and Hamas, as well as any other players, and there will be others, because now the Arab alliance is coming in behind Hamas, simply because they are afraid to be left out in the cold. As for Erdogan and Turkey, they're going to stay out of it. All they want is to be part of any kind of subsequent trade agreement that come in after everybody has either been killed or, and whoever is left standing, they want to be part of some kind of deal where if there's a trade route that goes from South Asia and India, which will side with Israel, whoever its judge is, if it is on the panel, they will side with Israel. But unless Narendra Modi gets murdered, and for the sake of planet Earth, let's hope he does, because he's an idiot. He's a tool of Netanyahu. They're two of a kind. So what Turkey wants is to be part of the receiving end. The plan right now is there's a trade route that they're trying to establish from India through the Arab countries, then to Israel, and Turkey wants to be on the receiving end. And it was only mouthing off and threatening Israel, and because of it has asked the U.S. to sell it 40 F-16 fighter jets. So all of its rhetoric about we're threatening Israel, all of that rhetoric was to threaten to make the Americans worry. So it's been announced that eventually they're going to give Turkey 40 F-16 fighter jets, but it had to make sure that Turkey would also approve the admission to NATO of Sweden, and it already approved the admission of Finland. So that's been accomplished, but the Turkey is not going to get its 40 F-16 fighter jets until after Israel, if Israel approves and if Israel wins. And now the big, big irony is that Israel just might not win this war. It has a bunch of crazy, demented soldiers who dance up and down saying, "We're Amalek and we're coming to get you. We're going to kill you." When you have soldiers like that, you know you've got psychotics on the loose. And what they're doing is repeating the words of their psychotic leaders, the prime minister and everyone in his cabinet, including Benny Gantz. The only one who refused to join the war cabinet is Yair Lapid. And Yair Lapid, I believe, is of Sephardic origin. So that may be why he's not so psychotic, whereas the Jews from the Balkans and the Ashkenazi Jews are all totally demented. They're entirely capable of the bloodlust and the blood libel. That's the other thing they're claiming, that South Africa taking them to the ICJ is a blood libel. Of course it's a blood libel, because that's what the Jews are known for. That's what they did in Europe for centuries, is blood libel. And we can talk about that in another show. I can give you all the information, because I now believe it is true, when there was a time when I did not believe it was true. And at the same time, you've got the psychotic Lubavitch, who have taken over Brooklyn, although the evidence is going to be covered up, because maybe some of the upper crust of the elite of New York and Brooklyn were involved in the secret tunnel of that mikvah in that's associated with the synagogue. But the Lubavitch have said all Jews belong belong to one soul. Therefore, Lubavitch claims ownership of the soul of anyone who is Jewish. And their purpose was to bring in the unassimilated, those who are not committed to Judaism. They want to lure them in. That also means Christians. Christians who are converting to Judaism for the money, or they did do that in Eastern Europe when they were poor. They brought them in. Those were the Shapotnikis and the Subotniks. So they brought them in a long time ago, and Lubavitch has taken over. Call it Chabad, Lubavitch, or whatever. Chabad means prophet, and Lubavitch was the name.
Layla. Layla, take a deep breath. We're on a break, and we'll be right back with Layla Paul. Stand by.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Revolution Radio, every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes. That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building. Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Layla, I think we may diverge even on both counts with regard to the ICC. My impression is the case against Putin was as fabricated as the cases against Trump right here in the USA, and that Russia is not a signatory to the ICC. With regard to the ICJ and the case against Israel, if they don't find genocide in this case, then the International Court of Justice might as well disband, because this, there could not be a more clear-cut case with greater amount of evidence. So it seems to me the whole world is watching. And if the ICJ doesn't come down with a prompt, and it's got to be prompt because this is an ongoing genocide decision unfavorable to Israel, then I think faith in international law is going to collapse. Your thoughts?
The ICC, you don't have to be a member of the ICC. Only the country in which you might temporarily be located, if they're a member of the ICC, they have an obligation to apprehend you and deport you so that you can be prosecuted. So it doesn't matter if Russia's part of the ICC. I doubt that they are. The point is, that's why when Putin did travel to the BRICS, he avoided the countries that were members of the ICC. As for the ICJ, it only deals with nations. And both Israel and the Palestinians, I believe, are members.
Yeah.
Israel, anyway, is a member of the ICJ. And I think maybe Palestine is as well. But the Palestine I'm talking about is the corrupt Palestine under Mahmoud Abbas. Now, I heard somebody say that Hamas was the only choice at the election in 2006. Wrong. The Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, the corrupt subcontractor to Israel, whom all Palestinians know to be utterly corrupt. Mahmoud Abbas and his gang were building themselves villas and not paying the people for the things that they needed. So that is why, in the election, there was both Hamas and the PA, the Palestinian Authority, possibly a third party, I don't recall, but Hamas won overwhelmingly, and everyone was stunned. Jimmy Carter monitored the election, and he declared it honest and fair. Now, Hamas won because they live among the people. They live like the people, as cheaply as the people, with the same risks as the common people. And that is why they are beloved by, even by those who have survived all the horrors, the unimaginable horrors, even they still to this moment support Hamas. And I will say that, and it is not simply the Islamists or anyone who is likely to be portrayed as an Islamist extremist. I am a Christian born in Bethlehem. No non-Christian lives there. We have been there. Our birth records, our baptismal records, our marriage records are all in the vault of the Church of the Nativity, where they've been protected since the 13th century. That is how far back I have proof of my Christianity. I am a Christian, and I utterly, thoroughly, and totally support Hamas. I praise them. I thank them for what they have done. I thank Hezbollah. I thank Iran. I thank the Houthis. They have given us all pride. It's not a matter of religion. It's a matter of justice and humanity. And I am saying this not only as a Palestinian, but because I love the human beings that Jesus Christ, God, created. That is who is being defiled by these vile, demonic creatures that call themselves Israelis. They are not even are truly bloodthirsty. They have a bloodlust. So, yes, they deserve the label of being guilty of blood libel. It is not a libel. It is a truth. We have watched them spill blood unnecessarily of innocent children, babies, newborns, tormenting them all until they all died, old women. It's just horrendous what they've done. No human being behaves so sadistically in such an utterly depraved manner, except a beast, a satanic, demonic beast, and all of his gangs. And anyone who is part of this Lubavitch gang, whether you know it or not, if you think you are a Jew or you think you're practicing Judaism, you are practicing Chabad Lubavitch, because even the Reform, which used to be liberal and more humane, has shown itself to be as much an adherent of this demonic group that has taken over Palestine and renamed it fake Israel. So everybody is guilty. Now, as for whether, of course, the judges, if they're human, they have to, for the sake of their own dignity, the judges will have to issue an order to cease and desist immediately. But they have no, their mandate does not include enforcement. And Israel is going to thumb their nose at it. Just like they thumb their nose at everything that any normal human being would never have done. If they were even remotely capable, if they had a fiber of humanity and compassion, they would never have been doing this for 102 days, killing and torturing, intentionally burying bodies under rubble where they would decompose and cause enormous psychological stress, mental stress to those poor human beings that are human. So it doesn't really matter. It matters to the world. It gave us all hope that South Africa, and I commend South Africa, it showed how intelligent they are, how brilliant they are. They put together such a beautiful, well thought out, well presented case with evidence and precedents, quoting everything that was needed. While Israel's representative shuffled this, my papers got shuffled, I lost my place, and what did they come up with? The usual, way overworked tropes, the usual blood libel, or accusers of blood libel. They hate us. We're the victims. We've always been the victims. It's anti-Semitism. It's like the Big Bad Holocaust that we actually designed and enacted. We made sure we helped the Nazis make sure that they did enough so that we could provide enough evidence to torment the world and make them succumb to us, make everyone afraid of us. And then we gathered money from Germany and we gathered money from all around the world. We were like a vacuum cleaner. Never mind the Rothschilds and their corruption. They just sucked money up like a vacuum cleaner from all around the world and built up a concrete, fake, biblical Disneyland in Israel. That's just a Disneyland that you've gone to before those rotten Jews, those rotten fake Jews, those Yiddishers came to my homeland and destroyed it. It was beautiful. It was still like it was in biblical times. You could have gone and seen the real thing in Palestine, but these monstrosities have made it a concrete imitation, and they've made it just simply another Disneyland so that they could suck you in and take your money. It isn't just the corrupt, evil, evangelical Zionists that call themselves Christians, but are not Christians, but are even more satanic than the satanic Jews. They have all taken over. It's just a piece of land, somebody says. There is something more there, something you feel when you get there. If you have a good soul, you feel the spirituality. You can inhale it. If you are corrupt, you know you've come to the right place, because this is where you want to bring evil. You want to saturate the Holy Land with sadistic evil. So what's going to come of it? It's up to the world. Well, now, I will have to say, name is Leila Hatoum, and another superb brown-skinned man with a huge intellectual mind, and his name is Youssef Maori. And he has interviewed the French. They have been planning for 9 years. That's what the fight was all about in Yemen. They were trying to divide it up into six federal states, and each one of them, France, Britain, England, and Israel, and Saudi Arabia, were all going to take the federal state that they wanted, that had the minerals that they wanted. But the Houthis prevented it. The Houthis defeated them. That is, those were the great warriors with an ancient history, where the Queen of Sheba reigned over the land of Saba, the kingdom of Saba or Sheba. So that is a place with thousands, millennia of history behind it, of brave, brave warriors. You cannot defeat them. Even though thousands of children died of cholera, they managed to keep fighting, and they're not only that, they came back stronger. The more the sadistic demons try to destroy them, the more those who are filled with virtue and devotion to God, the more they come back stronger and stronger. Israel, your days are numbered. Even Henry Kissinger knew that. I remember Henry Kissinger saying, I don't remember what year it was, but he said that Israel would not last 100 years.
No.
76 years.
Yeah, he said Israel will no longer be here in 10 years, and that was about 10 years ago. So we'll see.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about more than 10 years ago, many years ago, when he said that it would not last 100 years. So he knew. He knew that it was impossible because they're not homogeneous. They're not united. They're not a real people. They're just cobbled together souls that have supposedly been claimed by the demonic Lubavitch. The Chabad, Chabad is supposed to mean the prophet or the Messiah, their Messiah. That is who the Lubavitchers have. And one of them was Schneuer, Zellman, I don't have his name in front of me. There have been five or six. And they started first in Russia, in Belarus, and then Russia, and then they were thrown out of there. By the way, the czar prosecuted the Lubavitchers because he recognized how evil they were. And are you ready for this? This is a real shocker. Even the Bolsheviks not only imprisoned them, but the Bolsheviks executed some of them and threw them out of Russia. So they ended up in Poland. And then from Poland, again, they were thrown out. And where did they go? To America. This place that seems to accept a lot of garbage as long as they claim that they're Jews and they have money. God, God, poor America. A land with such great promise. When I think of the founding fathers and what they were capable of and the country that they built, the constitution that they forged together with their brilliant, it was wonderful. And the productivity, the Protestant work ethic or the Catholic Christian work ethic, where people, and even in Islam, there is the same. God respects the hand that works for what he earns, and with the other hand, he has no respect for the one who accepts welfare. Even in Islam, that is why so many people who are either Christian, Arab, or Muslim Arab, or any other religious group that comes from that region, always wherever they go to any other country, where natives may be poverty stricken, the Arabs from the Arabian Peninsula, always within one generation become at least middle class, and by the second generation they are wealthy because they are entrepreneurs. They are not lazy. I watched my father work day and night. When we came here, we were discriminated against. There was no freebie. There was no medical care. There was no handout. Nonetheless, in fact, we were taunted by horrible racism. In 1950, Canada was a racist. In fact, do you African heritage, we were all WOGs, W-O-G as in George, WOG. And that was, oh, gee, don't be offended. That's short for polywog. That is how racist the people were in Canada because everybody came from Britain. So, yeah, we were called WOGs. We were called DPs. We were even, ironically, because people here were so ignorant in the 1950s, that Palestine was a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multicolored country where people were able to live in multi-religious country. They used to call us dirty Jews and dirty fleas. Get out of town. Even though we were lily white, my parents spoke English and dressed very fashionably because we came from the upper crust. We worked for it. My mother and my father's parents, fathers, always went out of the country. My father's father used to be a sculptor in Mother of Pearl. He was invited. He used to go to Russia so often because, of course, of the Orthodox tradition. He was actually invited by the Tsar's family to attend the 300th anniversary of the Romanov celebration. On my mother's father's side, he traveled all through Central America and Europe and came home with money galore, which, of course, was a lot of money for our part of the world. And then my mother's grandfather had acquired a lot of land, and he was a farmer, orchards, figs, oranges. The Jaffa oranges during the days of Palestine were shipped all over the world. They were the best oranges. When grapefruits used to be big, not shrinky little things like they are now, these GMO thingies that we call grapefruits, oranges used to be so large and sweet, those were the Jaffa oranges. They were coveted all over the world. And that is what the Palestinians built. That is what they shipped out. And when I worked for the Institute for Palestine Studies in Beirut, one of the first things that angered me was that they had created the Histadrut, which insisted they must know no Jew, no Yiddisher that came from outside was allowed to employ a native Palestinian. Right from the start, the intent was genocide and ethnic cleansing for those who were not killed. There was horrendous butchery that occurred, mutilations, sexual abuses that are beyond description. I won't even try to describe what they did to the people from the 1920s until 1947, until finally we fled. We fled before the British even fled. They were afraid of the Zionists, so they fled. And so we left before the British did. And the reason for that was because my father was sufficiently politically sophisticated to know that if we did not leave before the British abandoned their mandate, then we could become stateless refugees. But because we left before the British left, we were able to take British-issued passports as Palestinian citizens, but we were British subjects. And that is why we came to Canada, because in 1947, January 1947, Canada had its first legislative act where it was able to issue its own citizenship. Prior to that, any Canadian resident was a British citizen. So we came as British subjects on track for Canadian citizenship. That's why my parents chose such a place with such ugly weather and where there was so much animosity and ignorance about what Palestine was. Otherwise, we would have done like what others had done during the Ottoman period or just prior when they realized that the Yiddishers were coming in from Europe and they knew that they were going to take over their home. So they managed to take whatever they could and they ended up in South America, Central America, the Caribbean, southern areas in southern the U.S., California, Texas being the primary state, as well as Florida. They chose places with better weather. But my father wanted to be guaranteed automatic citizenship and as British subject. Anyone, once the British abandoned, just was in probably in March of 1948. It was a couple of months before the Yiddishers unilaterally declared independence. And then they were given conditional in the May of 20, I can't remember what year it was. It might have been 1949, but I believe they were given conditional membership to the United Nations if they were to promise to follow all of the rules of the United Nations Charter. That included to be a peace-loving country that respected all of the rights of its indigenous population, that abided by the partition plan, that also agreed to allow the refugees to return to their homes in what the Israelis claimed, the Zionists claimed, as their Israel. But they have not done that, and the UN does not have the integrity to eject them from the UN. And the Arab countries could have done that. With their oil resources, they could very easily have initiated action in the UN to have them ejected, their membership rescinded, abrogated, because they violated the conditions of their admission to the UN. But even so, it doesn't even take that. Any normal human being knows that they don't belong in the UN unless the UN itself is corrupt. Then Israel is right at home. However, although the Security Council has always been corrupt, and the UNGA has always been bribable with a blackmail, many of them subject to blackmail for many, I can give you lots of examples. When we have time, I can tell you how they won the United Nations. They just barely scraped through to get enough votes, and the struggle they went through to bribe, threaten, badger, threaten to kill members of their family. And according to what I've heard from reliable sources, I haven't read it myself, but I have heard that even JFK mentioned in his memoirs that Truman took a case full of $2 million in cash given to him by Louis Brandeis, your also respectable Supreme Court justice, and his toady, Felix Frankfurter, another U.S. Supreme Court justice, who was doing the illicit bidding of Justice Brandeis, all of your Supreme Court justices. So, you know, it's a tragic case. It is a tragic case where there are too many people in the U.S. who seem to think that just because the patriotic founders of the nation wrote an excellent constitution, and some of them were ethical and were indeed filled with integrity and love of the new country they had created, you had a lot of corruption within. You had a very wealthy class that created your country for their own advantage, because they could not get the class privileges in England, because in England there was the law of primogeniture, where the oldest son inherited everything. So the younger sons had to go to the New World or to the Caribbean to make their wealth. In fact, it's ironic when you read Jane Austen, which is sometimes is a good comedy, you'll see that all of the wealth came from the West Indies or the East Indies, another place where the British robbed so many treasures.
Layla, you've been absolutely sensational. I cannot conclude today's show without referring to the book by William Pepper, The Plot to Kill King, given today as Martin Luther King Day. William Pepper was James Earl Ray lawyer in the trial for the murder of Martin Luther King Jr., and even after Ray's conviction and death, Pepper continues to adamantly argue Ray's innocence. This myth-shattering expose is a revised, updated, heavily expanded volume of Pepper's original best-selling and critically acclaimed book, Orders to Kill, with 26 years of additional research included. The result reveals dramatic new details of the night of the murder, the trial, and why Ray was chosen to take the fall for an evil conspiracy, a government-sanctioned assassination of our nation's greatest leader. The plan, according to Pepper, was for a team of United States Army Special Forces snipers to kill King, but just as they were taking aim, a backup civilian assassin pulled the trigger. And as I mentioned in my opening remarks, King did not die on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, but was taken to a hospital more distant than necessary, where a racist doctor had declared he'd finish him off. He just went out of the ER and smothered Martin Luther King with a pillow. Spent time to get your family that people you're out in love, because we do not know how much time we have left.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Industrial Complex podcast here on Revolution Radio, Studio B, every Wednesday, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Get fit, empowered, physically, mentally, and spiritually.
My name is Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion.